you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Hudson against Palmer and the consolidated case. You may proceed when you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, the two petitions in this case bring before this court two important constitutional issues pertaining to prison administration. The first issue, that presented by the petitioner, is whether a prison inmate has some reasonable and legitimate expectation of privacy while in prison, so that he is entitled to the protection of the Fourth and Fourteenth Amendments against allegedly unreasonable searches. The second issue, that presented by the cross petitioner, is whether a prison inmate whose property has been destroyed by the random, unauthorized, but unanticipated act of a guard has in law been deprived of property without due process, when the state provides adequate post-deprivation remedies which are adequate to make the inmate whole. These issues arose out of an incident which occurred at Bland Correctional Institution in September 1981. Bland is a state-run penal facility which houses 450 felons. According to the inmate's complaint, the prison guard conducted a shakedown, that is, a search of his locker. But the shakedown was not routine and was conducted for purposes of harassment. He further alleged that the guard destroyed some of his property. Although the guard denied these allegations, the district court accepted them as true for purposes of ruling upon the guard's motion for summary judgment. The trial court concluded that the allegations of deprivation of property did not constitute a taking without due process because of this court's reasoning in the case of Perot v. Taylor. The trial court also concluded that the allegations of harassment did not rise to the level of a constitutional violation. The Court of Appeals affirmed both of those rulings, but the Court of Appeals found that the inmate had some minimal right of privacy entitled to protection under the 14th Amendment. And the Court of Appeals ruled that a guard could not search unless there was an established program or policy for random searches, or, in the alternative, that the guard had some reasonable basis for believing that the prisoner possessed contraband. The petitioner submits that the Court of Appeals erred with respect to this conclusion, and I would like first to address this issue. It is clear from this court's prior opinions that an iron curtain does not exist between the Constitution and our nation's prisons. It is equally clear, however, that prisoners suffer a substantial reduction and even loss in many rights and privileges. In each case, before the court determines that an inmate possesses a right, it carefully weighs that claim in light of the acute need of prison administration for prison security, because that is the paramount need which prison administration is charged with. And secondarily, it will weigh the claim in light of the effect upon the prison inmate. Now, with respect to the claim that a prison inmate possesses a right of privacy, this court is well aware from its many cases that prisons are dangerous places. They're used to house dangerous men. Inmates may seek to assault, to brutalize other inmates. They may seek to assault guards. They may seek to escape. The introduction of drugs and weapons into this situation can only exacerbate an already dangerous place and situation.
General Broaddus, can I ask you a question about the scope of your submission?
Yes, sir.
As I understood your opening statement, you were suggesting that the Fourth Amendment has no application to searches in the prison. You also say that there's no protection for the prisoner against seizures in both search and seizure. I notice the complaint alleges that the officer shook down my locker and destroyed a lot of my property, that is, legal materials, letters, and other personal property. It's not so much the search as the destruction of the property. Is there a protection against unreasonable seizures? That's what I'm asking, as opposed to searches.
Justice Stevens, with respect to the destruction of property aspect, that, of course, would be controlled by Parrott v. Taylor. With respect to the seizure of property, we would submit that because there is no legitimate expectation or right of privacy, that the Fourth Amendment does not apply, and that, therefore, a seizure would not be controlled by the Fourth Amendment, but by some other aspect, if at all, such as the taking of property without due process.
Well, Mr. Broaddus, I suppose that if I'm a policeman and you're a suspect, I may have a probable cause that would justify my searching for and seizing a gold ring in your possession that's maybe worth $20,000. But the fact I may seize it in the Fourth Amendment sense doesn't justify me in keeping it at all.
That is correct, and I think that
that's what you meant by the Parrott rather than Fourth Amendment being applicable to the property destruction.
Yes, sir. And of course, in Virginia, there would be many other ways of which the inmate might recover that particular property through the inmate grievance procedure or through state actions. So he is certainly not without remedies to recover in that situation. Now, in order to minimize the problems which are brought about by the introduction of drugs and weapons into prisons, official surveillance is, and as this court has noted, traditionally always has been the order of the day in prisons. If one follows the analysis which this court has established for Fourth Amendment cases, which emanated out of Katz, applied more recently in the United States versus Knotts, and before that in Smith v. Merlin, one can only conclude that a prisoner does not have a legitimate expectation of privacy in prison. First, does the prisoner himself actually expect privacy? In this particular situation, we know from the prisoner's affidavit that he, and I quote, realizes routine shakedowns are necessary to properly run a prison, end of quote. So he himself had no actual expectation of privacy. But even if he did, certainly society is not prepared to legitimize such an expectation because society has recognized the paramount needs of prison administrators to search, to seek out weapons, to seek out drugs and contraband. Both society and inmates want prisons to be a safe place, but they can only be safe if weapons and drugs and contraband are kept out. So we would contend that because the prisoner does not expect privacy and because society is not prepared and has not in any way legitimized an expectation, that he has no basis for claiming privacy entitled to Fourth Amendment protection.
Now, what if in a shakedown, which you say is perfectly permissible, a random shakedown, well, even suppose it is, and the officer enters this cell and searching around, and he just picks up a radio and carries it out, doesn't destroy it. He just you say the Fourth Amendment's protection of effects just doesn't apply in a prison.
We would take the position, Justice White, that it does not apply. Of course, that's not the case here. There was simply an allegation of destruction of property without due process.
Well, I know, but there was a seizure of it. There's no question that there was a seizure. And I guess as the case comes to us, we accept that we assume that it was destroyed.
That is the allegation, yes, sir, which was accepted as correct.
But at least it was seized. And you say that the prison authorities are completely free from any Fourth Amendment restraints from seizing a prisoner's effects, even if they aren't contraband, or even if their possession is wholly consistent with prison rules.
Under the Fourth Amendment.
Is that right?
Under the Fourth Amendment, yes, sir, we would. I think that the Fourth Amendment right of freedom from seizures must be something different and separate and apart from the taking of property without due process.
But it certainly is a separate question from the search.
Yes, sir. But in, for example, Delaware versus Prowse, which could be analyzed as a seizure case, court was concerned with the intrusion upon the driver of the motor vehicle, his freedom from anxiety, the limitation upon his movement and whatnot. And those concerns simply are not present in prison.
Well, that may be that's the argument going to the search, the shakedown.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
But even on the search, supposing you had a prison system whereby they censored all the incoming mail, so it was all read before the prisoner was permitted to have it,
yes,
then he gets his mail. Could a guard go in and say, I think I'll read your mail?
There would be no Fourth Amendment prohibition in that situation, Justice
Stevens. There'd be no prohibition at all, then, would there?
Well, if that were to constitute abuse, then under the Virginia regulations, which prohibit guards from abusing inmates, the inmate would have redress under the inmate grievance procedure, which has been approved by the Attorney General of the United States. So he would have redress there, but he would not have it under the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution.
Well, just what remedies are available under state law in Virginia for redressing the property deprivations? Just the grievance procedure?
Justice O'Connor would be far more than that. The grievance procedure would be but the first, which would be available. Also in state courts, an inmate may sue in detinue, or he may sue in conversion and recover damages for destruction of property or recover the property itself in state court.
If the court were to agree with your view, is there any danger that the state might alter its grievance procedure?
I would certainly.
So that some of these same protections would not be available?
I would certainly think not, Justice O'Connor. I think that, if anything, we would ensure that grievance procedure operates the way it's intended to operate, because it benefits not only Virginia but also federal courts. And what's
the remedy if he prevails in the grievance procedure?
Under the grievance procedure, he would be entitled either to recover the property, have it returned to him, assuming it's still in existence, or to be made whole through payment for the value of the property. If the radio could be valued, he would be made whole by payment of the value of the radio.
Payments out of state funds?
Yes, sir. Funds are made available to the various institutions, and that's the source of the payment.
And who is it that makes the final judgment in the procedure, in the grievance procedure?
That ultimately goes up. It's a hierarchy level, if you will, sir. And depending upon the nature of the claim, it may be the superintendent of the particular facility, or it may be the regional superintendent who has control of many various facilities, or it might be the deputy director of the overall Department of Corrections. If there is no right of privacy under the Fourth Amendment, then surely there must be no right of privacy in a prison inmate.
Forgive my interrupting you again. I gather there's no judicial review.
Under the grievance procedure?
Yes.
That's correct, sir. There is not. We submit that there is no right of privacy which a prison inmate possesses under the 14th Amendment. To suggest that an inmate has an intimate right of privacy in his locker comparable to a woman's fundamental right of privacy to an abortion or a couple's right of privacy to practice birth control simply is novel at best. And to find such in a prison setting is simply untenable. Now, the Court of Appeals approach seemed to be calculated to give a little bit to the prison administrator and something to the prison inmate as well. We suggest that that approach not only splits the baby, it is simply unworkable. Under the Court of Appeals approach, the prison inmate would not have any greater enhanced freedom from searches. He would still be subject to random searches. But the Court of Appeals approach would certainly limit the capability of the guard to make a search in a meaningful manner such that it would deter the introduction into prisons of weapons and drugs and other contraband. Now, the unreasonableness of the Court of Appeals approach is demonstrated, we believe, by a 1976 University of Virginia Law Review article by Gianelli and Galligan, which was cited with approval by the court below. That article suggested that a plan should be promulgated on a constitutional grounds before prison guards may search. It would require limitations upon the frequency and the intensity of the search. It would suggest that if a guard were searching for a knife, that he would be able to search only in those places where a knife might be found. And once the knife is found, then the search would have to cease. We submit that such an approach is unreasonable and unworkable. It simply transforms the Fourth Amendment into a font of tort law without any privacy interest being present to be implicated. Such an approach would simply increase federal litigation without substantially advancing the rights of prison inmates. As I've indicated, we do not suggest that the prisoner is without any protection whatsoever. We do contend, however, that he may not wrap himself in the Fourth Amendment and use the Fourth Amendment to erect a wall between his activities and necessary security activities undertaken to a properly run prison. We urge this court to hold that the Fourth Amendment is not applicable in a prison. If the court rejects this position, then we would further urge that it should reject the requirement of the Court of Appeals that random searches can be conducted only pursuant to an established program or policy for such. We would urge this court to adopt an approach which would say that all prison searches for security purposes undertaken in a reasonable manner are per se constitutional under the reasonableness clause of the Fourth Amendment. That approach would be comparable to what this court has utilized in the 1972 case of United States versus Biswell, which was not cited in our brief, but one in which the court upheld warrantless administrative searches in the gun industry, even though probable cause and reasonable suspicion were not present and there was no plan for such searches. Finally, on this point, we would also urge the court to clarify that the normal rules of proof and going forward in civil cases should control a 1983 claim such as this, and not the burden-shifting approach which the Court of Appeals seemed to adopt in what might be more appropriate in criminal suppression motions in criminal cases. I would like to turn now to the second issue, that of the Perot v. Taylor. The petitioner submits that the line of cases beginning with Paul v. Davis and going through Zimmerman Brush do not depend upon the state of mind of the state actor or the state public official charged with the wrongful conduct. Indeed, Paul v. Davis, Ingraham v. Wright, and McCollum v. Baker, the action was at least arguably intentionally undertaken. The analysis we submit must depend instead upon whether the state was logically able to anticipate the wrongful act. If the state was not able to anticipate the wrongful act, then it was not in a position to provide in a meaningful manner a pre-deprivation hearing. In that situation, if it does go forward and provide in a meaningful manner a post-deprivation remedy, which is capable of making the victim of the tort whole, then under Pratt v. Taylor, the person has not been deprived of procedural due process and has not lost property without due process of law. In this situation, we have only an allegation of random conduct which was not sanctioned or condoned by the state. It was not pursuant to an official scheme or plan. Accordingly, the state action is not complete. And because the state action was not complete and the state has provided meaningful remedies, there has not been a taking of property without due process of law. In the reply brief, the cross-petitioner suggests that the petitioner seeks to constitutionalize the deprivation of property with their argument. If the state condoned the action here, then perhaps it would fall under Zimmerman Brush. But that is not the case. As I've indicated, we have only the random, isolated, single allegation of wrongful conduct depriving someone of property, and due process has been provided. So the deprivation was not without due process of law. In conclusion, we would ask this court to reverse the judgment of the Court of Appeals so that the matter may be sent back to the district court and have that decision upheld, dismissing the complaint.
What is the procedure that was referred to, the procedure that on which a prisoner can call for some kind of remedy?
Mr. Chief Justice, at the time of this particular incident, we had a grievance procedure in place which was similar to what is presently in place. It's not identical to the one that is presently in place. The one that's presently in place now has been approved by the Attorney General of the United States under the CRIP Act, 42 U.S.C. 1997, I believe, and provides to the inmate the opportunity to file complaints with respect to the manner and the way in which the prison is run, and to seek redress of any grievance that he might have through that procedure. He's provided opportunity for a meaningful hearing, and depending upon the nature of the claim, he may indeed have an opportunity to be made whole.
Very well. We'll resume here at 1 o'clock. Ms. Wyatt, I think you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, this case is here on summary judgment from a suit against a guard himself who conducted what has been described as a ransacking search of my client's locker and destruction of his property for harassment purposes. It presents two questions. First, whether there is now to be drawn around prison walls an iron curtain for purposes of the Fourth Amendment.
What would you say if, in searching a locker or the cell of a prisoner, they found a pistol or narcotics? That is an examination and seizure of these things without a warrant. What would you say about that?
I don't believe that under the analysis of search and seizures in prisons that a warrant is required, but I think we still might focus on the justification. If somebody went in to search to harass, I think it would still be an harassing search and seizure.
Would it be admissible against him in evidence?
The pistol? I think if it violated the Fourth Amendment as the law stands now, it would not be admissible against him.
It would not be admissible? Is that your answer?
Yes, Your Honor. It could be confiscated. Obviously, it could be, but...
How about heroin? 14 packages of heroin and in small packages for delivery.
I think all of that would be analyzed the same. If the search is a legitimate search, and that's quite broad in a prison context, you can search randomly if that's your pattern in the prison. You can search an individual if you have a particular suspicion. And under either of those circumstances, if you find the heroin, if you find the gun, they're, of course, admissible because that's a reasonable search and seizure under prison circumstances. But if you search to harass for no other purpose to harass, then you have violated the Fourth Amendment, and therefore the suppression issues would apply.
Well, what do you take it to the expression search to harass mean?
A search for no legitimate purpose at all.
Not looking for anything, in effect?
That's correct. Not looking, not expecting to find, not looking for contraband, not even doing this as a deterrent. I think prisons would have the right to have a search policy as a deterrent. Random searches, and I believe the Fourth Circuit recognized that and said that you could have a system of random cell searches, but there must be a system pursuant to which the individual is being searched. If you did it...
Now there certainly is a middle ground between a system for searching, or, you know, a prescribed set of rules, as I take it you urge, and the harassing search that you say is a search simply to no purpose whatever. I mean, I take it in that case a guard would simply figure he had nothing else to do and would just want to wander through people's cells.
I believe if there is no legitimate purpose, it would be analyzed as unreasonable. And I think in a prison situation, we have obviously a very broad standard of reasonableness.
Well, are harassing and no legitimate purpose equivalent in the way you're using the terms?
Yes, Your Honor, they would be the same. Harassing, as I use it, means not for a legitimate purpose. You can, if you have a suspicion that someone has contraband, even if you're gleefully searching him for that contraband, that's not for an harassment purpose. The way I'm using it is an abusive purpose. You are picking on someone in your custody. You are not doing it for any legitimate prison security or administrative purpose. And that is what we have on summary judgment in this case.
And so that's apart from any requirement that there be rules or anything else. I tell you, your view is the Fourth Circuit could be affirmed without laying down any requirement that there be rules for Fourth Amendment searches in prisons.
Absolutely. In fact, the question presented is simply whether the Fourth Amendment applies within prisons. And that is what the Fourth Circuit held. And the Fourth Circuit did proceed to address such issues as burden of proof, and of course petitioner has argued that that has been shifted and shifted incorrectly. I read the Fourth Circuit's opinion differently. And I read it to be that a prisoner must allege an unreasonable search and seizure, which is going to be, there's going to be a very small range of searches or seizures in a prison setting that will be unreasonable. Once he's alleged that, then the state can justify it if they do honestly justify it by saying that we have a pattern of random searches, or I had a particular suspicion about this individual. But to pick on the person, to do it abusively for only the purpose of harassment would be, and I think would be a classic case of an unreasonable search and seizure, and perhaps one of the only cases of an unreasonable search and seizure within a prison setting. I believe that is why petitioner has retreated to a bright line request for this court. I certainly suspect that petitioner is not in a position to request a bright line, but because petitioner knew that what petitioner was doing was wrong. But even if this court felt that a bright line was needed, I can suggest another line that I think is equally bright in a prison setting, which is that it is unconstitutional to search and seize for the purpose of harassment. I think that petitioner's position on the Fourth Amendment is unwarranted, it is unsound, and I think that for that reason the court should decline the invitation to sweep away this constitutional right any more broadly than necessary. Again, the only question that has been framed for this court is whether the Fourth Amendment applies in prisons, and indeed it should, even though that may only provide limited protection to a prisoner. With regard to the second question in this case, that is the due process issue and the question of whether a due process violation, whether an intentional abuse of deprivation can ever violate the due process clause when it violates a state's own laws, which is to say, when a state...
In your cross-petition, you stated the question only in terms of a due process violation, not a Fourth Amendment.
That's correct, Your Honor. In my cross-petition, the Fourth Amendment issue was raised in the original petition by the Attorney General's office. And I'm addressing now the issue I raised, which is the due process, whether an intentional abuse of deprivation is totally unprotected by the due process clause. I think petitioner, who has alleged it does not, has totally missed a major distinction in this case, which is a distinction between suits against higher supervisory officials or otherwise against general policies or procedures, and challenges directly to individuals who themselves have abused. In the former case, understandably, the analysis is going to turn on whether an act was a wrongful deprivation was pursuant to that policy or was instead a random act not authorized by the procedure, a fluke, or even an abuse under a procedure where the risk of abuse is low, as in Ingram. But that's not this case, and that analysis doesn't apply to this case. This case is a challenge directly to the individual who abused. And in that sense, this case is governed by Screws versus United States and Monroe v. Pape. Both of those cases involved challenges directly to the officials who abused, not to supervisory officials. And in both of those cases, the court said that it is no defense that the act is unauthorized. It is no defense that it is unauthorized, even if that means that a state then provides remedies and that, therefore, one might be able to receive compensation in state courts. This was rejected in Screws versus United States, where the court cleanly held, under a challenge to the individual official, that that intentional wrongful deprivation violated the due process clause immediately, and state court remedies are completely and totally irrelevant.
But can't you, isn't there a difference between the facts in Screws and the facts here, though?
There is a difference. That was a criminal prosecution.
It was a different kind of deprivation, too, wasn't it?
That was a life deprivation.
And it was all completed before there was any possibility of a hearing.
I think there could always be a wrongful death action, for example, in state court.
Well, would that make the person who suffered the deprivation of life whole? You can't restore his life, can you?
I think our principles of tort law accept the fiction that, for example, a suit for wrongful death does make that deprivation whole. But I certainly acknowledge that that is life, and that when we are looking at a procedure, whether we're talking about life, liberty, or property, may enter a Matthews versus Eldridge analysis, because that's the weight of the particular interest at stake. But this court has never severed property off from the other rights. And the Due Process Clause, of course, mentions them in the same breath. And what Screws held was that it didn't matter whether there were remedies after the fact. The deprivation immediately, at once, violated the Due Process Clause. In Monroe v. Pape, of course, we were talking about the Fourth Amendment. There, although the court does not focus very often, in fact, I think gives only a paragraph to which particular constitutional violation was at issue. Another factor that both those cases made very clear is the fact that abuse of power is really at the heart of the 14th Amendment.
You probably can clarify it very quickly. I can understand the Attorney General's office in Virginia appearing in the case because it is one of their guards, one of their attendants that's involved.
Yes,
but is the state as such a party to the litigation?
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
Well, then what's the source of authority for any court, to lay down any regulations about random searches or any other kind of searches in a private lawsuit between a prisoner and a guard?
Well, Your Honor, I think that points out a very important distinction in this case. This case is not against a prison warden, as in Peratt. It is against the guard himself. As in Monroe v. Pape, there was an action against the officials themselves, but the court did not find it difficult in that case to say the Fourth Amendment had been violated. But
can the Fourth Amendment be violated by private parties?
This is not a private party, Your Honor, and that's one thing that Screws and Monroe both made clear. He acted without authority.
Well, I was taking you up on your statement that this was private.
I did not mean a private suit. I never meant to indicate it as a private party, Your Honor. He sued the guard. He sued the official who abused, but not the people who should have controlled the guard, not higher supervisory officials. He sued the guard, however, who quite clearly under Screws and Monroe was acting under pretense of law and would be a proper defendant under 1983 from that standpoint. And to the extent that he violated either the Fourth Amendment or the Due Process Clause, I think both are proper for adjudication.
But your claim has to be that the state, acting through this guard, deprived your client of his property without due process of law. It's not a question. The Constitution doesn't say no prison guard shall deprive a person of property without. It says no state.
Correct, Your Honor. That's exactly why I say that this case is mostly governed by Screws and Monroe, because that argument was presented in both of those cases, and in both of those cases, as in United States versus Classic before it, the court stated that the misuse of state power, the intentional misuse of state power, can be attributable to the state itself in the sense of the...
I think that the law is on that is quite clear, but I think the Parrott case says the final judgment on the state's deprivation of due process isn't to be pronounced solely on the basis of the action of a guard or a warden. It's what opportunity the state offers to alleviate the claimed deprivation.
Your Honor, if this were a Peratt case, I think the result would be the same. If this were a case suing the prison warden for having allowed this prison guard to do this, then we would look at, how frequently did the guard do this? Did they know that the guard was going to do this, or was this a random, unauthorized, unpredictable act by the guard under otherwise normal procedures? But that's not this case. This case is a suit against the fellow who did it. This is a suit against the abusive guard himself. The only cases that are very notable which present such a challenge are Screws and Monroe. And the analysis is not, therefore, the risk of error. It is not, therefore, whether this was random and unauthorized and uncontrollable by the state. Once you're suing the guard himself who abused, then you turn to Screws and Monroe and you say, does it matter that it's unauthorized if it's intentional?
Do you think Parrott would have come out differently if the two assistant wardens or guards in the mail room had been sued rather than the warden?
Parrott was a negligent case, and I believe if you sued an individual who had negligently lost property, and he said, yes, I negligently lost the property, that you would have no due process violation, but you would have no due process violation because that is negligent. It is not an abuse of power. I think that when you're looking at the local level, when you're looking at the specific officer, it makes all the difference in the world whether he is abusing his power and acting under pretense of law or is really involved in an automobile accident or computer error. Those are not under pretense of law.
Then, to your mind, the distinction really turns on negligence versus intent, not the superior versus the actual actor.
Your Honor, I believe it's both. As I understood your question, if we were suing the guard himself and said, you lost this property, you hit me with your police car, then, and it's a negligence, it's not that he was trying to run him over, that would simply not be a due process violation. What we have, of course, at this level is an intentional abusive taking. But both of those situations are different from a situation where we are holding higher people to account for policies, where we are saying the procedures you have enacted do or do not have a high risk of error. In Logan, there was a too high risk of error. In Ingram, there wasn't. There were many safeguards in Ingram which prevented this. But in all of those cases, and in fact in most of the cases that have been before this court in due process situations, we have been looking at supervisory officials for their policies and whether they allowed too many things to happen. And in that context, I think negligence can state a cause of action. But if we're looking to the individual himself for his own particular action, I don't think due process is implicated unless we're talking about an abuse of power. And I think Screws and Monroe made it very clear that an abuse of power was the very target of the 14th Amendment. If you follow petitioner's argument, an officer, and we must remember this is not just in prison settings, the due process issue is not confined to the prison setting. It applies to officers out on the street as well. If an officer can walk up to someone and grab his glasses off his face because he doesn't like him and grind them into the ground, petitioner's argument would say, as long as there's a state tort of conversion, the victim of that abuse is confined to state court exactly as if his neighbor had done that.
Right, on that very point, is this locker in his cell?
Pardon me?
Is the locker involved in this case?
Is that his cell?
Was that in his cell?
Your Honor, to be candid, I was a little confused from the record. I became involved in this case at the Fourth Circuit, and the references in the record refer to locker and indicate that there was a dormitory. So I'm assuming from the record that the locker was within a dormitory.
Well, I have a great problem with the search and seizure. If these papers had been laying out there, would that have been a search and seizure? If it had been laying on his table, on his bed?
Your Honor.
Would it have been a search and seizure?
If it were searched or seized for no legitimate purpose, well, it would have been a search and seizure, yes. The question of whether...
If he just picked it up off the bed?
Yes.
That would be a search and a seizure. Search and seizure.
I'm not sure if it would be a search. I think if he read it, it might be a search. Yes.
Well, how could it be a search? It's laying right there.
Is Your Honor talking about a plain view kind of exception then to a search and seizure? Perhaps then it would not be.
I understand your complaint that the guard mistreated this man. But I don't understand where the search and seizure comes in.
The allegations are, and of
your
course,
allegations
we're in summary judgment.
Don't help me. I mean, what's the evidence show?
My understanding from the record is that there is a locker and that the guard went into that locker and, as the descriptions from the affidavits indicate, ransacked the locker, went through the locker. And my client, and we're on summary judgment, says it was for no purpose. It was not searching for contraband. It was only to harass. That, to me, would indicate...
The guard agrees to that.
The guard, of course, denied that, but we're here on summary judgment. So for purposes of this case at this point, that would be taken as true. There were some affidavits filed in support of that saying, yes, he conducted a ransacking search of this man's locker. From the facts, I don't believe it was in plain view. He deliberately went in there. Now, if he went in for a legitimate purpose, we'd have a different analysis, but he went in to abuse.
The door could have been wide open.
It could have been wide open, and if the regulations allow the guard to go in there...
Well, what?
Your Honor,
I need to know whether to decide whether it's a search and seizure, whether it was sitting out in plain view. There's nothing in this evidence, this case, to show whether it was or was not in plain view.
There has been no indication that it was in plain view from either side.
Wasn't this remanded for a hearing?
This was remanded on the issue of whether there could be...
On the Fourth Amendment issue.
On the Fourth Amendment issue.
No, and won't all the things that my brother Marshall are inquiring about, would they be open to proof at the hearing?
They certainly could be. There are many issues left open to proof at the district court level.
Is it or is it not? That could be.
Your Honor, the Fourth Circuit remanded primarily on the issue of whether there was a Fourth Amendment violation under the guidelines it set forth, but there are many factual matters in dispute. I do not believe it's in dispute that it was a search. Plain view was never raised by the guard. Instead, he said it was a legitimate search for contraband, and my client said it was an illegitimate search for harassment purposes. And I think that they both concede then that it was a search for purposes of the Fourth Amendment. But again, this will be remanded, and there will be more factual evidence taken at that level. I do not know whether my client would prevail once we get back there. But here, for purposes of summary judgment, it was a search, and it was a harassment search.
Well, certainly this.
Did you rely on PAFE and screws in the Court of Appeals on the issue you raised in your cross-appeal?
I did not rely so strongly. I did urge that abuse of power was an important factor.
I noticed neither was cited nor addressed, as I see it.
I believe Monroe v. Pape was, as I recall, was cited. I did urge that the distinguishing feature there was the abuse of power.
Mm-hmm. Did you rely on screws?
I don't recall. Perhaps I did not. Obviously, if it's not cited in the Fourth Circuit level, I didn't.
Because I understand screws to say that in order to deny a federal right, you have to make it explicit that you're doing it for that purpose.
There is a willfulness requirement in Screws because of the criminal nature of that particular civil right.
No, Screws says you have to say so.
That the Civil
Screws
Rights Act
says if you are an officer and you're denying a prisoner or an individual of his rights, you haven't made it clear that you are beating him up for the sole purpose of denying him his rights.
Your Honor, I believe we have Screws, although it's not life, it's property. We have at this point in this court the facts that this was destroyed for an abusive purpose only. And by abusive, I mean under pretense of law, but for an unauthorized or illegitimate purpose. I think the hypothetical I was giving, I think, would show that there is something inherently and fundamentally unfair about an officer on the street being able to go back to the glasses analogy, to do that and to confine somebody solely to state court.
Why is that fundamentally unfair if you'll get paid in state court the same thing you get paid in federal court?
Because there is something different that has happened. To say that is to say that the action by the official is no different than the action by the neighbor. And I think Justice Harlan very well put it in his concurrence in Monroe, as well as his later concurrence in Bivens, that an action such as that is different in kind from an action, the same action, by a civilian.
But the injured party gets compensated in full under the hypothesis. So I'm asking, why is it so obviously unfair?
I'm not sure what compensated in full means. I think there's another problem, however. If it is a constitutional violation, you can also sue for injunctive relief. If we're saying that this is no constitutional violation because you can get full compensation in state court, then we're also saying you can't get injunctive relief. The state's duty is complete upon the compensation, and the guard can keep on doing that day after day. This court recognized earlier this year that the Due Process Clause protects against the arbitrary use of power in Colander versus Lawson. If it protects against the arbitrary use of power, certainly it protects no less against the abusive use of power.
May I ask you another question about the Screws case? Which of the opinions in the Screws case do you primarily rely on?
I think that which makes my point most clear is obviously that of Justice Rutledge in concurrence.
Does he refer at all to deprivations of property in that opinion, do you know?
No, he does not, that I know of. But I, again, do not know of any opinion of this court, and I would also caution the court, if we are to make a new distinction here, the area of due process, I don't think anyone would doubt, has many complexities already. And I think if we start also a new sort of layer of distinctions here between property and life and liberty, it's going to be all the more confusing. Although it may enter the analysis when we're looking at a procedure about how much process is due and when and how, under Matthews versus Eldridge, what we have here is no process. And when there's no process, when there's an abusive taking, it shouldn't matter whether it's life or liberty or this pen here. If this is my pen and an officer takes it, I shouldn't be relegated to state court to sue for its value back. And once I've done that, the due process clause is silent. And an officer can keep on taking that forever. I recognize that.
Well, he can't do that if you're right in your Fourth Amendment position.
I think they're two entirely different guarantees.
No, but isn't that right? If you are correct on your Fourth Amendment submission, he couldn't keep doing it over and over.
If this is a seizure, no, he could not, because we'd have a constitutional violation. But I think they're two separate ones. I think, again, that the Due Process Clause itself recognizes a prohibition against arbitrary use of power. And I simply cannot believe that it any less protects against power not arbitrary but abusive. I mean, it says that an officer cannot pick on someone for no reason. Certainly, it cannot say any less that someone can't, that an officer should be able to pick on someone for a bad reason, for an abusive reason. I think this court has recognized in many cases that this very conduct, an abusive deprivation, is at the heart of the Due Process Clause. It is conduct which was the target of the 14th Amendment, and as Screws did hold, though, yes, that was a life deprivation,
Ms. Wyatt?
Yes.
I guess the court held in Ingram versus Wright that state tort remedies were adequate process for students subjected to corporal punishment in school. And that, of course, is even a liberty interest, not even a property interest. How is the interest you're talking about more significant than that?
Justice O'Connor, I think that's a very important question because I read Ingram a little bit differently. I do not read Ingram as saying that state tort remedies are going to be always sufficient. And, of course, Ingram clearly does not address substantive due process. Ingram was one of these challenges to higher supervisory officials, the school principal, an assistant principal, and at one point I believe even the school board, though they got dismissed before they reached this court, they were the defendants, not the teacher who spanked. That is the case, therefore, where the court looked at the risk of abuse and said, we've got state remedies that are a deterrent. We've got openness. We've got a number of other reasons that the risk of abuse is very small, and therefore the procedure satisfies due process.
Well, might not that be true here, too, for a deprivation of property with state remedies that could be considered adequate?
I think it would be if we were challenging the prison that allowed it. I think the prison could say, we had no idea that this guard was abusive, this was random, and the procedures we've instilled are basically secure against such abuse. But that's not this.
You think Ingram would have been a different result if one of the teachers who had administered the punishment were a defendant?
I think it absolutely would have and should have been. I think in that case we might have been talking about something more substantive. That teacher who had done the spanking to a hematoma might be held accountable in a way that somebody who had adopted the policy would not be. And that is exactly the distinction that I think is very important in this case and that has been missed by petitioner. This is not a challenge to supervisory officials. This is a challenge to the officer himself. There is no excuse for his failure to deny due process. If he wanted to take, he knew how to do it. He didn't do it legally, and he violated at once the due process clause. Accordingly, I'd ask this court to affirm the decision of the Fourth Circuit, holding that the Fourth Amendment applies to prisoners and reversing the faulty due process ruling of the Fourth Circuit below. Thank you.
Counsel, may I ask a question?
Yes.
About the facts? There was another guard or officer with Hudson at the time, was there not?
I'm not aware of that, Your Honor.
The affidavit from Mr. Hudson on page 14 of the appendix, perhaps I'm misreading it.
Your Honor, I do see where it says Officer Lefeu.
Third paragraph?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why wasn't he sued?
Your Honor, again, I was appointed at the Fourth Circuit level. I believe from all of the pleadings, I certainly get the clear indication that it was Guard Hudson's abuse, it was Guard Hudson's repeated harassment that my client was most concerned with, and in fact he primarily sought injunctive relief against Guard Hudson. It may be that another officer assisted or participated, but he wasn't suing everybody for everything. He was suing.
Did you request an affidavit from this other officer also?
Your Honor, I was not involved at the district court
at
level.
Point.
No, I was not. I was appointed at the Fourth
Circuit.
Does it
suggest at all that there may not have been harassment if there were two of them there and one of them wasn't even sued?
Your Honor, I believe his complaint goes on to give a number of instances of how this officer abused. Of course, they most clearly involved the search and seizure. They also involved the destruction of his property. And although another officer I see is included in one of the incidents, I think it really adds credibility to my client's claim that he wanted Guard Hudson removed. And that
You've
was
only sued on the one incident, haven't you?
He included a number of different harassment incidents.
In his suit?
In his suit, in his original suit. He talks about something that happened on September 16 and 17. He talks about the fact that a false charge was brought against him by Guard Hudson. That Guard Hudson had harassed him before, that he said, next time I'll really mess your cell up. He did a number of things on the 16th, I believe, also the 17th.
He referred to the 16th and the 17th only, I think.
Perhaps so, Your Honor. But he makes comments there that it was more than that. And, again, I think it is important and telling that he sued primarily for injunctive relief.
May I ask if you were appointed in the Fourth Circuit?
That's correct.
Was he represented by counsel in the district court?
No, he was proceeding pro se. No further questions. Thank you.
Do you have anything further, counsel?
Not unless the court has questions, sir.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted. We'll hear argument.